Well, good morning. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. It's 8:15, and our first guest is Summit County Council Chair Roger Armstrong, and he is here to give us an update on the meeting yesterday. Thanks for coming by.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So the longest and most interesting discussion, I'm told, was the Canyons Transportation Master Plan, and Roger and you and other council members seem to challenge the resort a little bit to do more to cope with the traffic. I guess the basic goal in the transportation plan at the Canyons was to reduce traffic there by 27%, and now the folks at the Canyons are saying they want to shelve that. Can you talk a little bit about what's happening and what they're thinking and who these folks are? Are they Vail or are they the developers?
Well, I think Vail is a piece of it. So there's an organization or an entity at the Canyons called the CVMA, and the CVMA really represents the business interests in the Canyons. And the CVMA and the county have entered into some amendments to the development agreement that governs the Canyons over time that address some of the transportation issues there. And one of the issues in one of the last meetings we had a couple of years ago, there was a line in the development agreement or in the transportation plan, I can't remember now actually where it was even located, but it talked about reducing traffic by 27%. And as a council, we kind of couldn't figure out what that 27% was. 27% of what? Cars, daily trips, what did it mean? And we asked staff to go back and take a look at that as the transportation plan came back to us. The CVMA comes back every X number of years and kind of tells us what they've done during the intervening period to address traffic impacts and what the plans are for the future. And they've actually been a very good partner, and I want to emphasize that because they were part of the assessment bond process that allowed us to have money to build the Kilby Road Park and Ride, to redo Kilby Road, to address some other parking and transit issues. So they've been good about that. They have the right to purchase or lease 100 slots at the Kilby Road Park and Ride for employees, and that increases to 200 slots at some point. And I think part of what I was reacting to is we had a significant snow year this year. I think we'll hear from the Chamber of Commerce that skier days were up nearly 20% for last season. Lodging was not up by a similar amount. Lodging was up by a much smaller amount. And that suggests to me intuitively that we're seeing a lot more traffic coming in, a lot more day skiers perhaps coming in because of Icon and Epic and other reasons. And I think it's not just the Canyons and the CVMA. I don't want to pick on them. I think generally in this community, we have a lot of impacts from employees driving in and out. And Park City and Summit County have been diligently trying to upgrade our transit system to make some of the routes more frequent, more, you know, easier to take transit. 10-minute headways on the white bus, the electric bus. It makes it easier for people to use transit. We now need our major employers especially to start coming up with programs internally that will help push their employees to take transit. We can do that with, emergency rides home. We can do that with them incentivizing or requiring employees not to park on site, to park at the park and ride. We can come up with programs to do that. And I don't want to minimize what our transit folks are doing. I'm positive that Caroline Rodriguez and Alfred Knott are out there talking to the major employees to try and get these employers to try and get these programs in place. But what was delivered to us yesterday and what we talked a lot about was what the impacts are that we're going to see at the Canyons, where White Pine Road dovetails into 224 at that intersection. That's a failing intersection during certain times of the year when we've got big ski days. The Canyons Village Drive intersection into 224 is also going to fail at some point very soon. By, I think they said 2022 or 2024, we're going to see failures there, level of service F, which means just longer than acceptable wait times as you're driving by, just due to increased, you know, we've got growth in this community, more and more people are coming in. I do believe the ski passes are contributing to that, and we need to figure out a way to get people to use transit and alternative means, ride shares and other means. We know that several of the hotels in our jurisdiction are marketing to their guests, you don't need a car. Leave your car at home. We've got shuttles. It's easy to get here, and once you get here, you're not going to drive around. And I think even the surveys that they do of guests that come in show that if you bring a car, it usually winds up sitting in the parking lot at the hotel. People aren't using it to make their way around the community. So there's been a pretty big lift by the hotel services in the use of their vans. Transit ridership is up. I was pleased to see that, I believe, on average, the passenger loading on and off of buses at the canyons is something approaching 750, I think, a day, which is, I think, a good start. That's not where we want to be at the end of the day. Anecdotally, just riding the buses during Sundance and other high traffic events, the comments that I hear from, in particular from Sundance, from people that were riding the buses when Beth and I were riding the buses, is that they were very surprised and satisfied at the ease of use of the bus system. And many of those people were going into or out of the canyons, just the nature of when she and I were traveling. So I think we're building a system that is trending to be more user-friendly, more efficient, and now we need to get better buy-in, I think, from our major employers. That would include the hospital. That's, you know, we have a lot of big employers in this community, and I think we need to continue those discussions and raise the game a bit.
Okay, so you've covered a lot of things. I'm making some notes here, but you talked about failure potentially in that intersection with Kenyon's Drive and 224. But it seems to me that we're at failure. I mean, anybody who tries to drive out there on any winter day now, it's not just weekends, but at 3 to 5 o'clock, it's pretty failed. You're sitting in a long, long line. It's going to take you a half an hour to get out there. Failure mean? What is, if that's not failure, what is?
Failure, you're really sitting there for a long time. I think, you know, Carmageddon is a great example of failure. People could not move. It was gridlock. Level A service is you're moving freely. There's no other traffic. B, there's a little bit more. C, there's some delays, but they're completely acceptable, and then it trends down until you get to level of service F. And level of service F is you're sitting there for unacceptably long periods of time. I don't mean to make light of it, but, you know, even not on our toughest days. And when we talk about level of service F and the failures at those intersections, we're really talking about on peak days, on the hardest traffic days. So it's not something that we're looking at on a year-round basis. But level of service F is when you're just kind of stuck for some period of time, and that lasts for an hour or two on high peak days. I laugh a little bit because, you know, I came here almost 15 years ago from Los Angeles, and level of service F in Los Angeles is a lot different than it is here, and it's constant. So we do have traffic challenges here, and we are battling them. And I think you heard some of that discussion as Park City was trying to assess the proposed changes from, for Highway 248. And there was a bit of a disconnect between what UDOT wanted for that road and I think what Park City wisely wanted to see there to allow for better transit. And I think with BRT, if we can enable that, and again, if we can get people to take it, it is going to give us a lift. And I know that there are, you know, some people sitting at home right now saying, yeah, but you don't serve my neighborhood. And that's true. We have to figure out better routing. And at the end of the day, there may be some areas that we can't reach. But if we can reach the core areas and high population areas, the majority of them with efficient bus service, I think we can forestall a lot of these problems. You know, I think one of the recommendations was at that intersection, turn it into 7 lanes with 2 turning lanes. And when we start adding more asphalt, more lanes, we exacerbate the problem. And I think that's a challenge.
So as far as the incentives, I mean, is there a serious consideration on the part of the employers to provide incentives for employees to get on a bus? I mean, pay them when they walk on the bus, or what are the incentives?
I don't know the answer to that. I think that there is a mix there. I think, you know, on the just from the employee standpoint, if there's, again, efficient, easy service into and out of where they need to go, if they can move around the way they generally want to, the ability to save wear and tear on your car and the ability to save gas and other considerations should be something that people would be interested in. That's self-interest. On the employer side, I assume that there are various ways that they can incentivize that. I don't know how they would measure it. And I know some are. You know, we had, I don't know how active the transportation management organization that Summit County and Park City formed several years ago now, three, four, 5 years ago, to actually have these discussions. I hope that they're still having meetings about this and trying to figure out a way to make that work.
Hmm. Okay. Just one more item on that. You did say that the Canyons people or the Canyons businesses have supported the Kilby lot. And do they support the Ecker Hill lot as well financially, or
it's the Ecker Park and Ride lot? That's the one we're talking about. And yeah, so there was a $23 million assessment bond mounted in the Canyons, and that bond is paid for entirely by certain parcels by the assessment of a tax on certain parcels within the Canyons that contribute to the traffic. And they agreed to use part of that money to buy the lot that will house 1,107 employees on site, and we'll have a grocery store right next to the transit center. There'll be a shuttle on site. $5 million of that money went to build the Ecker Park and Ride lot and went to redo Kilby Road to allow it to have more traffic and to slow that traffic down, because we know that those the volume of that traffic is going to increase, so we need to moderate it a bit. And it's working for that. And I know people have some different ideas about whether Kilby is a success or not as a road, but it's doing exactly what it was designed to do. It's slowing the traffic and it's allowing more capacity there. So that seems to be working.
Yeah. Okay. Quickly, we'll move on to the fair. It sounds like it was a great success, albeit there was that issue around the demolition derby and the symbols coming off of that were on the cars there. And we talked to Kim Carson last week, and she sounded pretty committed that the council would be making a change with that going forward. And I'm just wondering, you know, it's partly, I think, cultural too, because I had attended the Oakley Rodeo and mentioned this. You know, most of the time the clown, which is an integral part of the rodeo, most of his interactions with the audience was denigrating certain groups of people, women, LGBTQ. And I just wonder if there does need to be sort of a shift in terms of how we're managing that, and a real commitment on the part of our, you know, our officials and leadership to make sure that those things are not just allowed because they're culturally part of the history of it.
I would agree with that. I think that, you know, the county has to be very careful in terms of how it regulates the content of any kind of speech. And that's, you know, it cuts both ways. We've seen, you know, out of the federal side, prohibitions against using the words global warming or climate change or other words that don't match with, you know, where they want to go. And I think that there are groups of people that find that offensive, and there are groups of people that find other language offensive, and the county doesn't have the ability to regulate specifically content. We could, you know, for example, if a flag is offensive, we can't regulate one kind of flag, but we can say there can't be any flags. We can say there can't be any symbols on cars. We don't get to pick and choose what symbols are okay. The government generally doesn't get to do that. There are some limitations in that. But I think the notion that, I don't think anybody, knowing the people that mount the Oakley Rodeo, knowing the people that operate the Summit County Rodeo and the Demolition Derby, I think that being thoughtful, not just about any certain kind of messaging, but we want to create a family atmosphere. We want to create an atmosphere that's welcoming to all types of people so that they feel comfortable and they don't feel offended. And I think those are fair conversations to have and make sure that people are just sensitive about that. I think, you know, most corners of society are becoming more conscious of bias issues. And as Tom Fisher said yesterday, you know, part of what they've spent time on at the county just on the administrative side this year is looking at unconscious bias in hiring decisions, in the way that we implement things. Are we, just based on our own personal history, are we doing things in a certain way? And once you shine a light on it and say, you know what, maybe that's not the way we want to continue to do things, and maybe that's having an unintended harmful consequence towards some people, then I think most people, most reasonable-minded people would say, you know what, you're right, I hadn't thought about that. We can probably change things up a little bit to accommodate that and be a bit more sensitive. So,
okay. Thanks, Roger. My
pleasure.
We're going to have to leave it there, and I appreciate you coming by.
Great to see you.
All right, take care.
Take care.
My next guest is Dr. Jeffrey Botkin, who is a professor of pediatrics and associate vice president for research at the University of Utah. Hi, how are you doing, Dr. Botkin?
Good morning. I'm doing great.
Great. And you're here to talk with us about a discussion you gave last night on the ethical issues in editing our genes. And, you know, we hear a lot about the exciting new developments in genetic technologies, things like CRISPR, and how it enables editing of the genomes of bacteria, animals, cells in our bodies, and potentially human embryos. So talk to us a little bit about what your presentation was about and how reliable is this technology?
Well, it's an exciting time in genetics because of what's occurring now is sort of a transition from a time in which we have had the ability to sort of carefully analyze our genes and genomes and sort of understand what each of us has in the way of DNA sequence. And that gives us information about health risk, for example, but also provides information for scientists and clinicians about potential ways to attack these conditions once we know them better at a DNA level. So that's sort of the informational challenges. But what's emerging now, you know, as you mentioned, with the CRISPR technology, which has emerged over the last 5 to 10 years, is really a pretty sophisticated way to actually intervene with genes and to be able to cut out abnormal genes, potentially add in new healthy genetic material if you know what you're targeting. And so it's turning out to be an exciting time in that respect, but raising, from my perspective and from a lot of people's perspective, some challenging ethical issues as we decide how to potentially use this powerful technology in the right way.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about what are genetic disorders or genetic illness? What are the, you know, as lay people, what are we looking at?
Yeah. Well, all of us, of course, all life forms are really controlled by, at least partially controlled, I should say, by our genetic makeup. And humans have 20,000 genes approximately in our systems that code for how our bodies function or perhaps don't function well. And when you have a genetic mutation or certain genetic variants, those can lead to disease conditions, and familiar ones for many folks would be things like cystic fibrosis that can cause lung congestion and digestive problems in children, or sickle cell disease that's very common around the world as a cause of very painful, debilitating illnesses. And these are conditions that are caused by single gene defects, mutations, if you will, that can be passed from parent to child. Now, a lot of these conditions, excuse me, is probably estimated something like 10,000 different conditions that are caused by single gene problems. Most of those are extremely rare, but a few like cystic fibrosis and sickle cell disease, perhaps Huntington's disease, are really relatively common conditions, and a lot of us are familiar with muscular dystrophy would be another example of a genetic condition of this type. So they're uncommon individually, but if you lump them all together, it's a very common cause of significant disease in society, and particularly for children. And something like 40% people have estimated of children in hospitals like our primary Children's Hospital will be due to one of these sorts of genetic conditions. So it's really an exciting opportunity to begin to tackle these genes. Now, most more common conditions that people suffer from, like diabetes or mental health conditions or heart disease, these are not caused generally by single gene problems, but really by a constellation of dozens or hundreds of genes coming together in ways we don't fully understand. In addition, of course, to the environmental factors like exercise and diet and those sorts of things that interact with our genes in very complicated ways.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about how ethicists weigh in on the technology, specifically like of the CRISPR technology, being able to cut out sections of a gene sequence, I guess, and introduce a block or introduce a repaired, piece of technology, genetic
right.
technology. What do people think about this, the people who think about ethical issues?
Yeah, and I think what I'll do is just make a couple of comments, sort of unpack the different ways in which this technology might be used. It sort of raises somewhat, or rather significantly different ethical issues. And it's probably interesting to note that the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, which is the major funder of medical research in the country and really in the world, since the beginning of this whole genetic revolution, 25, 30 years ago, they've set aside 5% of the budget for genetics to look at the ethical, legal, social issues. And it's really the only institute at the NIH that sets aside money specifically for ethics-related research. So folks have been concerned for a long time about a whole host of ethical issues that work in the genetics field raises. So for this CRISPR interventional sort of genetics that we're emerging into, there's some issues that relate to treating disease in children or adults. And some of these would be, a good example would be sickle cell disease, where the notion is you take the bone marrow out from the person, you can treat it using CRISPR or similar technologies in the lab, change those cells so that the mutation has been eliminated, grow those cells up, and then reinfuse them back into the person. And the notion is, rather than a bone marrow transplant where you're using somebody else's bone marrow that might be rejected, this is the person's very own cells that have been altered with this genetic technology. And the notion here is that these folks then would be cured with a single treatment. And very exciting preliminary results in that regard with these types of treatments. Now, the ethical issues there are they're challenging, but they're not overwhelming. Some of the key issues just relate to safety. Are you getting those genes into the right place, and are they working the way you want them to? And if you're making a mistake, part of the challenge is it's pretty tough to get those genes out again. Now, if you start an experimental drug or if you have an experimental device implanted, you can stop the drug or take that device out and eliminate the risk associated with that. But once you have a gene inserted in your body, pretty tough to get that out. So those are some of the ethical challenges, mostly around safety and research ethics that are part of that. But folks are also talking about, quite realistically, altering genes in human embryos. And this really could be done for two reasons. One, of course, is to try to prevent the person that would grow from that embryo from suffering from a genetic condition. And then secondly, the prospect there would be possibilities of enhancing that embryo in ways that people might think are advantageous for that person. Now, most of the emphasis now, realistically, has been on trying to think about preventing disease in the future person that would grow from that embryo, but we don't know enough about safety at this point. And so as you insert these genes and then grow a person out of that embryo, lots of legitimate concerns about how that's going to play out and when we might have enough knowledge about safety to do that.
So let me
ask Dr. part is something that most folks do not feel comfortable with any time in the near future.
Sure. So, Dr. Bakken, how accessible financially is this type of treatment or this have there been clinical trials? Have people started to show some progress who say, have sickle cell anemia, who have Huntington's disease, that type of thing? I mean, has that been happening in the medical world?
Yes. Not so much Huntington's at this point, but there have been a number of clinical trials that are still in the very early stages, but actually some of these tools have now been approved by the FDA because there's been enough data to show how safe and effective they are. And so one that was approved by Medicare just this last week is called CAR T cell therapy. And this is a treatment for cancer, certain types of cancer. And basically the notion here is you take T cells out of the person, and those are part of our immune system that attack cancer cells. You supercharge these cells with receptors that specifically target the cancer, and then you infuse that back into the patient. And the notion is these cells will hone in on the cancer and specifically attack it. So very exciting. It looks like a number of people have been cured with this treatment, and it's been now approved. But a significant issue is the cost. And the cost for this is between $375,000 to $475,000 per treatment. And on the other hand, it's a potential single treatment cure for cancer. And so it has been approved for that. The second one that's just been recently approved is a genetic therapy for a devastating condition of children called spinal muscular atrophy. This is a disease that, in the more severe form, will lead to a child's death in the first couple of years of life through progressive weakness. Well, it looks like now there's a genetic therapy for this that that may well be extremely helpful, if not curative. The treatment for that is now estimated to be $2.1 million for a single treatment. So
not accessible. I mean, it just, you can do clinical trials, and those lucky people who get to be part of that may have some great results. But realistically, will health insurance companies pay for these kinds of treatments?
Well, that's open to much more public discussion. And I think the fact that Medicare has approved this CAR T cell treatment for cancer is encouraging that will be available for folks who meet the criteria for this. For the other things, SMA, I think it remains to be seen how insurance companies are going to decide to cover these. And of course, children who have these devastating genetic diseases are expensive to care for anyhow. And so, something like $2 million wouldn't be on top of other treatments. It would replace the cost of the other treatments that the child may receive. So I think we really do need to sort that out. But you're right. For the time being, most of these things are going to be still in the experimental stage while people try to figure out, what's the best way to do this, how safe is it, and what's a realistic estimate of the cost.
Sure. Well, fascinating topic, and I appreciate you coming on to talk with us about it. How can people find out more about this work you're doing at the University of Utah?
Well, a couple of exciting opportunities here. The University of Utah has really been a leader in the genetics field for decades, and due to the wonderful collaboration with our community that tends to have large families and tends to track those families over time, and that's enormously helpful for understanding genetics. University of Utah also has one of the most sophisticated websites called the Genetic Science Learning Center. That's really one of the, and perhaps the most frequently traveled website for understanding genetics. And so a lot of this information would be there in a way that is presented for folks to be able to better understand what all of these exciting developments mean.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your giving us this time this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
That's Dr. Jeffrey Botkin, Professor of Pediatrics and Associate Vice President for Research at the University of Utah. Well, you're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour, and our next guests are Shelley Barris, the Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity, in with Allison Kulo, joining us here to talk about the groundbreaking event that happened last week at the Silver Creek Village for Habitat for Humanity. And it sounds like it was a great celebration and big ceremony. And this is the first two single-family homes to be constructed at the Silver Creek Village. And those who attended on the August 8th event included representatives from Village Development Group, Wells Fargo, Think Architecture, Vail Epic Promise, and Summit County. And the family who will reside in the first of the two homes was also there to celebrate, in addition to board members, staff, and volunteers. Wow, what an event. Thank you for coming by, Shelley.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what is this Silver Creek Village project? What does it mean to Habitat and to the families that would be eligible?
Right. Well, for us, it's really this amazing game changer that we've been working on as a board and staff for about 3 years, just taking a look to move out of what we were building in the past. We're kind of infill single homes at a time, one home at a time. And we really wanted to find, you know, where's a neighborhood? Where can we be building multiple homes so we can stay in year-round construction? Then we can also increase the number of units that we're providing for the community. So it is, for us, a really big project. And then just physically, it's a pretty big project as well. You know, about 1,300 homes or units will be there. A little over 300 of them are targeted to be affordable. And so we're so excited to have this opportunity to work with Village Development Group and have an amazing donation of land that's going to allow us to do 26 units total.
26. And Allison, is there any place in Utah that has a program like a project like that as far as the size and the scope of it?
Shelley may know that answer
right.
better than
for,
I.
For Habitat, we you know, are kind of excited. We are at the current time the Habitat affiliate that has kind of the largest single project that is going on right now. So that's kind of exciting.
Mm-hmm. Very exciting. And have you identified other families that would be eligible to be inhabiting and helping to build those homes?
Right. Well, we're really excited to get out in the community. We're working really closely with Park City Municipal as well. And we're starting a lot of education classes that are going to be happening this fall, which is sort of a good first step, right? So some HUD first-time homebuyer classes. Habitat offers some additional financial preparation classes. And that's kind of our first step to get people in, and we get a chance to talk about our projects and start that kind of application pipeline that's happening. So we're really excited to get that going. Our first phase of the next, our next phase, the first thing that we'll be working on is a 10-plex, so attached townhomes. And so that's definitely an increase in numbers. And so as soon as we're through with these first two single family homes, which we'll do in the next year, we'll be starting some townhomes.
And those additional homeowners haven't been identified yet. And so, again, this is just a great time for anyone in the community who's interested in being part of the program. We highly encourage them to reach out to us now. Once the application process comes due, there's just so much work to do. So we'd love to be able to have them attend education classes, really prep for it so that they're ready. But, yes, we're going to be looking for a lot more homeowners.
So you've identified two of the 24, two families of
right.
the 24, and then you've got this 10-plex. So is it that's kind of a different model,
right.
isn't it, typically, that Habitat uses just the single-family home and that kind of thing?
I think for us it's a new product that we'll be incorporating into our work, but Habitats all over the country you know, definitely are using this type of model, and the density is really helpful, right? So land costs are a little high in this community, and so the more units we can get on one piece of land, the better, and it helps us just provide more housing. So we definitely have a lot of mentors in the Habitat world out across the country that we're working with in moving into this different product.
Sure. And the location, of course, that the village setting makes it more walkable, more transit-oriented, schools nearby, that type of thing.
Right. I think once the, you know, project is kind of built out, it definitely has a lot of those kind of elements. And already I love that the first thing that got built in this project out there is a little community park. Actually, two little community parks and trails are already in place. And so that's kind of nice to move in and have some of those things already there.
So what should people do who are interested in applying and starting that process or learning more about it?
Yeah, they can call our office and talk to our housing services coordinator. Her name is Brianna, and that's 435-658-1400. We also have on our webpage a great like contact information form that's really simple. You can go to habitat-utah.org and fill out an I'm interested form and put that you're interested in our homeownership program, and it goes right to Brianna and she follows up with everyone. And we have a list that we gather all that information on and send them all kinds of information about things that were that are available, as well as we will notify them when we're taking applications.
Okay. Anything else you want to add, Allison?
No, I think we're great. We're excited to have this opportunity to be able to start building again.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming by. That's Shelley Barris, Executive Director, and Allison Kulo with Habitat for Humanity. It's a mouthful. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
My final guest this morning is Cam. She is going to be performing with Park City Institute's final performance on August 24th at the George S. and Dolores Dory Eccles Center for the Performing Arts, and of course part of the 2019 St. Regis Big Stars Bright Nights concert series. Now, Cam is known for hits like Diane and Burning House, and she'll perform songs from Heart Forward, Untamed, and Welcome to Camp Country. So there you go. Welcome, Cam. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Hi, so nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so you're closing out the summer program for the Performing Arts Institute with a big country show. And Institute Director Terry Orr says, you took the Stagecoach Festival by storm. What do you think she means by that? What'd you do there?
Oh, that's so sweet to hear. I mean, I'm from California, so I love being there at that festival. And I was lucky enough to perform right at sunset, and it was just such a beautiful time, and just when everybody's coming out for a concert, with everything going on right now, it really is meaningful for everyone to come out and just have a good time with music and be together. And it just, we planned that show from start to finish, just like the one that we're going to do here coming up for you guys. It's just, it's meant to sort of take you on a ride, you know, and you get to get up and dance and sing and cry and laugh. And it's just a whole moment where you get to just be a little bit outside of yourself. So I'm glad it worked.
Yeah. So she also commented about your high energy performance. What's going on up there on the stage? What does
we make it, it's a full band show. Run around, there's definitely some jumping and headbanging and just joke telling. And I mean, the whole thing is, it's a pretty fun thing to be a part of. And especially when you're in front of, you know, a lot of people, your energy has to reach all the way back to the back. So it's, I think it's a good sign when it resonates in such a massive place like Stagecoach, but it's also really fun to have places that are, you know, close enough where you can see people's eyes and kind of have a connection with them. But yeah, the whole show is meant to be something that really takes you somewhere.
Sure. Okay. So what should people who aren't familiar with your music, where should they go to learn a little bit about you and your music? And what would you recommend?
Yeah.
What would you recommend maybe the top two or three, you know, that you've done?
Yeah. Burning House is the one that sort of kicked it off. That's the one I got nominated for a Grammy for, and that's like the big country ballad hit. Diane is a really fun one. It's a response to Dolly Parton's Jolene. So it's the other woman speaking back, and it's a really up-tempo dance number. That's what country does so well, where you're dancing around singing something that's actually really intense and dark. And then I'm a songwriter too, so I have songs with like Miley Cyrus and Sam Smith, and I feel like the Sam Smith one would be fun to check out. It was last Christmas. It was an Apple commercial, and it was on his Thrill of It All album. It's called Palace, and it's this really just kind of gut-wrenching, stark, clean ballad. It's really beautiful. So maybe those three would probably be the best intro to what you're going to get at the show.
Okay, great. great. So tell us about your first solo album, Heart Forward, in 2010.
Yeah, actually, I got started just doing music independently. I actually, my parents were good parents and made sure to let me know that music wasn't really a viable career option. And I actually got started in psychology. I did psychology research at UC Davis, UC Berkeley, and Stanford, because I'm from the Bay Area over there in California. And as I was transitioning out, saying to myself, you know, I asked my professor, I love music. I love psychology. What should I be focusing on? I really just don't know where I'm supposed to be going with my life. And she said, picture yourself 80 years old. What would you regret missing out on, psychology or music? And that made it really clear for me. Like, I would really regret not putting the time into music, no matter how it turned out. And so Heart Forward was kind of this first collection of songs that I just sort of gave a stab at, just trying to figure out what this is all about. It was all the same time I was trying to write songs for other people and kind of get my feet wet in the music world. So it kind of was really just like a small independent release, and just did it all on our own, kind of in, like, you know, parents' basements and stuff like that. So it actually isn't really a big thing. Most people don't even know about it. But then once I kind of started writing songs and got things noticed in Nashville and by this kind of Grammy award-winning producer, Jeff Basker, who he's the guy behind Kanye West, Beyonce, Pink, Taylor Swift. That's when things sort of took a turn for, like, oh, maybe my parents started to be like, okay with this music thing. Maybe you're going to be all right, you know, get signed to Sony. So the major releases have all kind of come since then with Untamed. So that was, you know, my first major release. And that one, and then Diane from the new album that's about to come out. Those are the main parts of the show that we kind of keep together. And yeah, I'll play a couple new things actually off the upcoming album that haven't even been released yet, which will be really cool.
Oh yeah, that'll be great to have a preview like that. Now you talk about your psychology background, and it, from your bio, it looks like you've also done research at Stanford. But one of the things that really stood out is just your ideas about inclusion and how important music education is. And What do you mean by inclusion with respect to music education? What does that mean?
Yeah, well, I think it starts in education, and then it happens the entire way up the job chain, basically. But to me, if you look at music, and all kinds of research has fully confirmed this, it's very important to us as human beings. Music has existed in every society since the beginning of societies. In every corner of the world, which for something to be as ubiquitous as that means that it is integral to who we are. And that's something that you can't really lose sight of when you're talking about how important music is. It helps your brain. It helps your memory. It helps your learning. It helps so many parts of your development. So having that be available to kids, it makes you a better human overall. You're a better functioning human when you're exposed to music at a young age. And then as you go up, you know, the ranks of it, whether you're a musician, an artist, creator, the inclusion part again comes in, where unfortunately women and minorities are severely underrepresented. Sure. In a lot of the jobs, not just artists, but songwriter, producer. For example, I think as artists, women are 22% of the total. For producers, we're 12%. For engineers, we're 2%. So it's really underrepresented. And what happens is when you finally get to what's coming out of the radio or what's hitting people's ears through Spotify or whatever, you're only getting a small part of the story. So when you're hearing people's perspectives and what they've been through and things you can relate to, you're not getting to hear it from a diverse group. And so then when you're on the listening side, like most of us, you need that. You need to hear stories that represent you. You need to hear heartbreak that sounds like yours. You need to hear making it through difficult times and celebrating together. So on all levels, it's something that's, and it's not just music, but it's just so important with music because of how it affects all of our development.